So a world without national borders sounds like a really radical, futuristic idea. But Parag Khanna is a global strategist who believes that borders are already becoming irrelevant. He says borders are just imaginary lines on a map, and they are being eroded by the increasing connections between people. He told Steve Paulson how he would redraw the world map.
Borders are really just one type of line on the map, and in fact, they are mostly ghosts. At a day-to-day level, what shapes our lives more and more is infrastructure, by which I mean transportation, energy, communications, railways, highways, pipelines, electricity grids, internet cables. And by and large, more and more borders around the world are being transcended and paved over, literally, by all of this infrastructural connectivity. And yet most of our maps, no matter what country you're in, tend to just show the standard Rand McNally kind of, you know, atlas of the world that just has political boundaries. But if you were to draw an accurate map of everything that we as mankind have built, those things, put those on the map, and what you'll see is that we are way more connected than we are divided.
Okay, so to give me some sense, if we can do this on the radio, I know maps are visual, but draw me a couple of alternative maps about how the world actually works.
Right. Perfect. Let's start right here at home. The United States is a major consumer of Canadian natural resources. And in fact, that is the most heavily transited border for trade in the entire world. You can draw that. You can visualize that. You can create a moving map, if you will, of all of the trucks and all of the pipelines and all of the oil and gas flows and so forth that are actually transcending that border every day. So why don't our maps show that? We have Google Earth Pro, we have Esri, we have all of these technologies that allow us to create accurate, three-dimensional, living maps that show us how the world really works. And I want us to graduate from what I call the X-ray map, which is obviously just this sort of dull black and white thing, to the MRI map. You know, that's much more detailed and much more kind of living.
There's so many ironies here because politicians are obsessed with borders these days. I mean, of course, this is, you know, what immigration policy is all about. You're saying that's mostly irrelevant?
It's irrelevant in multiple ways. It's irrelevant because it's wrong, right? It's factually wrong. The arguments that are made about the necessity of borders because they are based on, you know, sort of faulty data around, you know, what we are actually preventing. They ignore all of the good things and all of the ground reality. So if you look at border demographics, you see populations growing along borders, like the U.S.-Canada border, like the U.S.-Mexico border, like the India-Pakistan border, like the Norway-Russia border. I point to border after border to show that how come all, if we're supposed to be hostile towards our neighbors, then why are people moving towards borders? Because they want to be near markets. They want to be able to trade. They want to be near thriving cities. And those people don't care what side of the border it's on. The border is a friction. The border is a hindrance. The border is an obstacle that gets in their way. And then, again, there are all the things you don't see. American companies now are investing in the Mexican energy infrastructure. They're investing in the Mexican automobile industry, all of these areas where Mexico represents a huge growth market for American exports. Why would you want to put up a border? I mean, if you're a businessman, right? I mean, if you're a real businessman and you think in terms of trade and exchange and commerce, the last thing you'd want to do is to make it harder to trade with fast-growing markets like Mexico.
And yet borders are what define countries, right? And as far as I can tell, the governments of the United States, Russia, China, the EU, you know, go down the line, they still wield enormous power. I mean, they wage wars, they make trade alliances, they build infrastructure, they do all kinds
sure.
of things.
I'm not saying that you will cast off the shackles of your national identity and that, you know, states and borders don't matter. I would never say that. I'm saying they're one layer. And again, think of history as sort of evolution and archaeology. We've had cities and empires and nations rising and falling for millennia. And what we're doing now is building so much connectivity between the major urban cities and population centers of the world that we're evolving beyond just thinking of ourselves as nations and states and borders towards a connected civilization of infrastructure and supply chains.
In my sense is, I mean, your argument is that to some degree, the nation state is becoming less important. The city is becoming more important, especially the megacity, these huge cities
yes.
that sort of become, you know, entities unto themselves.
They already are, first of all. So this is not science fiction. Most countries in the world, most of the time today, rest on the pillar of one city that is not only the most important city in their national economy, but is a regional sphere of influence unto itself, like a Singapore or an Istanbul. So that city is not in any way constrained, if you will, by political boundaries. And in fact, if you look at the great cities of the world, they've existed for thousands of years, and their influence is totally regional, you know, like a London or of course, a New York or a Miami, a Paris, you know, and all of these places. Their identity or their role in the world is far beyond whatever country, you know, happens to sort of, you know, supervise them nominally any given time.
Well, it makes me wonder if instead of, you know, the G20 or, you know, these global get-togethers of, you know, major nations, maybe there should be an alliance of global cities that come together.
Absolutely.
Because you're suggesting that's where the real action
and
is.
And that wouldn't be new either. I write in this book about the Delian League of ancient Athens. I write about the Hanseatic League of Northern Europe in the Middle Ages. And what my wish for the 21st century is to have far more what I call diplomacity, you know, diplomacy among cities. Cities think so differently than countries think, and they think in a far more positive sum, mutually beneficial, commercially oriented, peaceful and tolerant way. And, you know, again, we only have all of our own histories of mankind as evidence of what I just said, with almost no exceptions.
So play this out for me then. I mean, if there were this connectivity between particular cities, mm-hmm. I mean, what do you see that? I mean, sort of draw the map again for like particular cities that are connected to each other.
It's already the case. Every global city, by definition, is a connected city because that's part of what generates your value. Dubai became Dubai, not because it has a large population. It only has, you know, 3 or 4 million people. But its airline connects to every major city in the world nonstop because of its geography. It's not a military threat to anyone. It's not even the capital of its country. But it has entered the ranks of the most connected cities in the world, and that's what makes it relevant. This is how cities think. We should want the world to move in this direction, and fortunately, it is.
I want to come back to your example of Singapore, one of the places where you would now live. I mean, you said it's in some ways it's a model city, and yet I also hear there's kind of this authoritarian streak. You got to be careful about what you say. You can't really criticize the people in power. And I guess I'm wondering about the politics of all of this. I mean, you know, if we're tying so much of sort of our model of how the world works to GDP, I mean, what about other issues like freedom of speech, inequality, basic human rights?
Mm-hmm. We're not tying the model of how the world works to GDP. But that said, you know, if you think about the role of connectivity on rights and freedoms, you don't exactly expect a country like Turkmenistan to liberalize unless you're going to connect to it, right? Unless you're going to have more flows of information and trade and exchange. You can talk about it and badmouth it if you want to, but it's never really going to evolve in a modern direction, in a liberal direction, unless it's connected. Less connected societies have less of a stake in a peaceful international system. And so if you want to change North Korea, you want to change Iran, you want to change Russia, you can either threaten it or you can connect more to it. And that is a very, very concrete argument that I make.
Now, my impression is your analysis comes a lot out of your own life. You have lived in all kinds of cities in lots of different continents. And, you know, you talk about, you know, you've lived in Singapore, New York, London. I mean, it's as if you're...
Berlin, it's almost a great city.
You're not that attached to any particular country, it's like, I don't know, there's this, you know, people talk about being the global citizen or the cosmopolitan citizen. I mean, you're it sounds like.
Well, I suppose, but I mean, I don't view identities as being in competition, you know? I mean, I don't see why we should think about the 21st century as being wedded to the same ideological shackles as the 17th century. I mean, if you choose to see the world that way, that's your choice. But the world I'm living in and talking about, I'm not alone in, because there are 300 million people today who live outside of their country of origin. There are 300 million expats. And by the way, there are more American expats than ever in history. There are 9 million Americans living outside the United States. And, you know, you can have multiple identities today. The notion that they have to be exclusive to each other is just a very terrible ideological figment of one's, you know, historical imagination.
Well, it makes me wonder if national borders are going to become less and less important. Are we moving back to the city-state, you know, the thing that, you know, used to be around millennia ago?
Well, I'm very glad you used the sort of the historical reference and said back to, because for thousands of years the city has been our dominant sort of unit, if you will, of sociology and obviously infrastructure and even politics to some degree. Again, modern nation states are just a couple of hundred years old, and most of them are really just a century old. Most of the countries in the world today were born after 1945, and I don't just mean most of them; I mean 2/3. Of them. And as you can see in the Arab Spring, a lot of them really aren't going to last that long, right? So we have to remember the way, you know, what our actual story is, not what our theoretical story is, not what our international law tells us. We have to think about reality. And so we are already moving back to this sort of, you know, city state. And I think that's a very positive thing because, as I said earlier, cities want to prioritize connectivity. They cannot survive on their own. There is no autarky or self-sufficiency in a world of megacities. They thrive on relations with each other.
That's Steve Paulson talking with Parag Khanna. He's a global strategist and the author of Connectography.